Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the history of the samurai and how their legend was created, the longest siege of the First World War and why it has been largely forgotten, the woman who fought as a sniper during the 1916 Rising and later became a leading trade union activist, a novel set in 13th century Europe about the battle between church and state, and then to end the show, we'll talk to Marianne Elliott about a remarkable Belfast woman from the late 18th century. Last week was Easter Sunday and we brought you our show on Polybius. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. We begin with Samurai, a concise history. The idea of the sword-wielding samurai, beholden to a strict ethical code and trained in deadly martial arts, dominates popular conceptions of the samurai, and a new book traces the samurai throughout history, exploring their roles in watershed events. The book is called Samurai, A Concise History. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £12.99 sterling, so about €15. The author is Michael Wirt, and Michael, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Can we talk about the reality of the samurai, and can we talk about the myth? Because it seems that the image of the samurai was mythologized and in a way almost used for propaganda purposes in the 20th century, and that in turn has shaped how we view the samurai in movies and on TV and in books.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially in the first half of the 20th century, there's a lot of propaganda tied to Japan's imperialism, wartime Japan. You know, that samurai were selfless. They would rather die than have dishonor, and the implication being that young men, young soldiers themselves are the modern-day samurai. And that, of course, carried on into popular culture in Japan at the time, movies from the 30s and 40s, but also into popular culture in post-war Japan and here in the West.
Because it wasn't originally a warrior identity at all. They were originally just people who served Japan's nobility.
Right. So if we go back to the 9th and 10th century, kind of pre-modern history, right, they're serving the emperor and the nobility in Kyoto. Around the 17th century, they become much humbler. They're not really serving the nobility or the emperor as much as they're serving whoever the warrior hegemon is in Japan.
So how did it emerge then that they took on this other identity?
This other identity as kind of rank and file warriors, right? Well, it's quite interesting. I mean, in the beginning of the warrior social groups, say 9th or 10th centuries, they really are the most, some of them are elite nobles themselves, like the civil nobility in Kyoto. But then there are people who are just local power holders, they're vassals, retainers, you know, mercenaries, and not all of them are officially samurai as such. And as we go throughout the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, the number of samurai increase, the number of warriors increase, I should say. And then when we get to the 17th century, finally, through many centuries of growth, there is a warrior regime that says to warriors at the end of a large civil war, the Warring States period, that says, look, if you're going to be a warrior, you're going to be a warrior. If you're going to be a peasant out in the countryside, you have to be that. You can't be this kind of ambiguous in between. And all of the political power of the emperor and nobility is essentially gone. They're confined to Kyoto, and the warrior population has grown so much, they monopolize violence, and so they become the de facto power by the 17th century.
How good were they when it came to combat? Because again, there's that image of them as being these elite warriors. And as you show in the book, sometimes they could actually be quite brutal in combat. And you have examples of them cutting off noses and ears and using skulls as cups and so on. That there was a brutality to the fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, much of the popular culture in the medieval period depicts warriors as nothing more than beasts, right? Because they were so brutal. I would say the further back you go in history, the less brutal the violence was, and combat was not as complex as it maybe later became. Usually you have men on horseback shooting bow and arrow, and that is complex, but that's a very small portion of the number of people engaged in combat. Otherwise, you have sometimes just common people with pikes, or people with bows and arrows, you know, just lobbing arrows into large groups of people. You have, in the medieval period, more adoption of muskets, and that is something that you can train commoners with. So combat wasn't as, you know, these highly skilled martial art masters we might depict them to be. And really, the whole idea of martial arts as a field of knowledge, of study, really begins in the 17th century, rather late in history.
It's very interesting when you look at how the image of the samurai became part of the propaganda of the regime in the 20th century, but then also how it was revived after a period when it was kind of almost deliberately ignored. It was suddenly revived as part of the business culture in the 1960s.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there are two moments in modern history where the samurai are not celebrated. One is when the last samurai regime collapses in the late 1860s and the 1870s, samurai are seen as an embarrassment, right? There's a desire to be like a Western country, a European country, and the samurai are seen as, you know, a backwards example of that. But then at the end of World War II, anything that was deemed militaristic was banned by the occupation authorities in Japan. So anything that celebrated that kind of, you know, death before dishonor was absolutely forbidden in print or even in film. And so the kind of samurai image goes into decline a little bit until the end of the occupation in the 1950s. But then this idea of, you know, loyalty, no matter what sacrifice you need to make, becomes, in a sense, a part of business culture.
And in terms of then whether this image of the samurai is healthy or not, would you have a particular view?
Probably not healthy, no. I mean, it certainly benefits big businesses to have this idea that you sacrifice your health and your family and your well-being to work long hours, right?
And in terms of the wider image of the samurai, the myth of the samurai or the way it's been romanticized in the Seven Samurai and various movies and TV programs, is there anything wrong with having this idealized version?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that since probably the 1960s onwards, there has been a shift to what I would say is a much more realistic depiction of the samurai, that a lot of them are poor, they're struggling, they had a lot of problems, they weren't well trained in martial arts. And so I think that depiction is also influencing Western views of samurai popular culture. And I think that that is probably a much more healthier thing, if you will.
Okay, well, the book is called Samurai, A Concise History. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £12.99 sterling, so about €15. The author is Michael Wirt. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Over the course of a remarkable career, Margaret Skinner was a 1916 rebel, a member of Cumann na mBan, a trade union and women's rights activist, and someone whose story has long deserved serious study. And thanks to Mary McAuliffe and New City Press's Life and Time series, we now have that study. It's a wonderful new biography, Margaret Skinner, published in paperback by New City Press. It costs €17, and I'm delighted to welcome the author, Mary McAuliffe, to the show tonight. Mary, you're very welcome.
Great to be here.
I was very struck by something you said in the introduction to the book about how Margaret Skinner re-entered national consciousness in the run-up to the centenary of the 1916 Rising, and she was featured prominently, she was a sniper, but that in some way her story maybe was maybe just focusing in on that there was more to her than just this story of a sniper and just the story of her in 1916.
Absolutely. And I mean, she lived until 1972. She didn't stop being an activist. She didn't stop engaging with all sorts of politics after 1916. And it was great to see her come back into that story, you know, the sniper girl on the green. But I was really interested in looking what, you know, what brought this Scottish woman to Dublin and ended with her in the Royal College of Surgeons in 1916, getting wounded three times. And then what motivated her, what politicised her, or in our common or contemporary parlance, radicalised her. And then what did she do afterwards? You know, she leaves the story then. We hear a little bit then about the fact that she applied for her pension in 1925 and was turned down because she wasn't a man, because the pension referred to soldier in the masculine sense. Then we hear nothing else about Margaret Skinner, and she has a long and fascinating life.
Well, let's answer that first question you posed there. How did someone born in Scotland Scotland in 1892 end up then fighting in during the 1916 Rising?
Well, she was of Irish ancestry. Her father was from just outside Monaghan town, and her mother was of Irish descent. So they married in Coatbridge, and that's where Margaret was born. So they were very much part of that Irish diaspora in Scotland, Coatbridge first, and then they moved to Glasgow. And she grew up, you know, going to Gaelic League classes, hearing the stories of Ireland, coming home to Monaghan for summer holidays, where she said she saw the houses of the planters and she began to hear the stories of the famine and evictions and the dispossession of the native peoples. You know, she got that very, I suppose, nationalist story of dispossession and the colonization story of Ireland. And that inspired her. She also, by 1912, was a militant suffragette, known to the police, as she said herself. So it isn't just nationalism or militant nationalism that inspires her. She's also a feminist from the early years, her late teen years into her early 20s. She's the family did well in Scotland, so she trains as a teacher. She's very good at mathematics. She trains as a maths teacher. Both her sisters train as teachers. So they're well educated, well read, very much involved with the Irish diaspora, very much involved with Irish politics. And of course, Glasgow, Belfast, Dublin are very close, and there's lots of communications. And, you know, you see Pearse is giving talks there, Markovitch is over there, James Connolly, all of these men and women who are very much involved in this new politics of the early 20th century are not just giving talks all around Ireland, they're giving talks in Glasgow and various parts of Scotland where the Irish diaspora exist. And so she's not at one removed from what is happening in Ireland. She's very much aware of it.
There is something cinematic about her story during the 1916 Rising and, as you say, wounded three times. How significant a role did she play during that week of fighting?
Well, it is quite cinematic, and I would think that the one of the characters in the Revolution series, the woman who's most involved in the fighting, is actually based in large part on Skinner. She is very much a student, I suppose, or mentored by Markovitch once she gets involved in Dublin. She comes over to Dublin in December 1915. She brings some bomb-making equipment with her. At this stage, she's a member of Cumannamon in Glasgow. She has been working with the Irish volunteers over there to raid shipyards in Glasgow and get bomb-making equipment. And it's the women who are transporting most of that to Dublin and to Belfast because they are, well, better able to get away with it. They look more innocent, I suppose, and they're not under suspicion as much. When she comes in 1915, she actually draws a plan of Beggar's Bush Barracks at that time, a place where obviously the British Army had several of their regiments, with the intent of, you know, having a plan to blow it up once the Rising started. So she uses her mathematical ability, her ability, you know, to draw maps and plans. And she's very much engaged with the Irish Citizen Army. She is always informed, again from a young age, about nationalism, feminism, but also socialism. Very much engaged with the idea of the working class and rights for workers. She sees the poverty in Dublin. She's extraordinarily moved and angered by that. And so Connolly and Markovitch are really her two mentors. So although a member of Cumannamon, she fights the Rising with the Irish Citizen Army.
And as you say, motivated by the plight of the poor, and in the later years, also motivated by this sense of wanting education to be more widely available.
Oh, absolutely.
And that becomes a real passion for her teaching.
Teaching becomes a real, well, she was a teacher prior to 1916. She worked in a number of schools in Glasgow. And she goes back to teaching after the Rising for briefly for a short time. But obviously, once she makes the permanent move to Dublin, somebody like her wouldn't be considered somebody that a school might employ, particularly the schools are run mainly by religious orders. So it is not until 1927 that she gets some substitute teaching. And then in 28, she gets a full time job in King's Inn School, where she remains for the rest of her life. And education then becomes her raison d'etre and her activist. Our activist roles are mainly through the INTO then. from then on.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because if we had time for a full show, and someday we will do a full show on Margaret Skinner, we could have a long section on her involvement in the Civil War and the aftermath of that. But let's talk about some of these areas that, as you said, are not well known. Her role in the INTO. She ends up as president of the INTO.
She does.
She's involved earlier in that 7-month teachers' strike. She is a hugely influential trade union activist.
She's a hugely influential trade union activist, but also an influential educator. She thinks about the types of education that's happening in Irish schools. She's very much concerned with the type of education children with intellectual or physical disabilities are getting. She wants them to be educated within the mainstream system, but that the mainstream system would be fit for purpose to be able to deliver a proper education, not just to those without disabilities. She is very much concerned with the type of education, that it is solidly based pedagogically, and that all children should be educated. She believes in the power of education to lift people out of poverty, and campaigns all of her life. But she also campaigns, for instance, for payment for women teachers to be on a par with married male teachers, women teachers, and actually single male teachers as well. During her lifetime within the INTO, she actually, that is achieved, and I think in no small part thanks to the activities of Margaret Skinner. She is on that long 7-month strike. She's very involved in the Dublin branch of the INTO, and they're one of the more radical branches. And out of that branch come many of the founder members and early memberships of Conna Publicta, because of course they've they feel both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are not giving due attention to the plight of education in Ireland at that time. So they see Conna Publicta as being more socially responsible, having better policies around women, around class, around social policies. And Margaret gets very much involved in Conna Publicta as well.
And she ran indeed for them in the local elections.
She did, and she didn't win a seat, but she put her name down in Irish. And she feels people didn't recognise that. Whereas Margaret Skinner would have been a well-known name, her name in Irish, Mairead Ní Scinadóra, just didn't resonate with anybody.
Didn't resonate with anyone. One thing that really struck me when I opened the book was your dedication, and you've dedicated it to four remarkable women in your family. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was thinking about it. I was going to dedicate it to my grandmother, who was in Cumann na mBan as a 19-year-old during the War of Independence, very much involved, the secretary of the local branch in our village in North Kerry. And then I thought, well, there were other women in my family also in Cumann na mBan. So my three great aunts and my grandmother, all of whom were active participants during the War of Independence and indeed into the Civil War during that period and on afterwards. They, unlike Skinner, they weren't involved in national politics, but they all continued to be very involved in their communities and obviously bringing up families and very concerned about the type of Ireland that we got after 1922.
So it's a nice personal dedication, and yes, Shows how we have these links and connections to the not so distant past. Yeah. How do you think we should remember Margaret Skinner?
I think as a well-rounded individual, as somebody who thought deeply about the type of politics she espoused. She said Scotland was her country, but Ireland was her nation. She was very much concerned with the rights of women, with the rights of her nation, and with the rights of workers. She spent her life with another woman. So she also had a private life that really was a support system to her public life with Nora O'Keefe, also a member of Cumann na mBan and very much active during the Civil War. Both of them were in jail, Nora in Kilmainham and Margaret in Mountjoy in the North Dublin Union during the Civil War for most of a year. And they live a life for 40 years or more together. So that hidden histories come out as well. Both of them spent their lives in the service of workers, in the service of the state, in the service of trade union activism, very much on the left, very left-wing politics. Both of them remain in Cumann na mBan into the 1930s. So they're committed women. In the introduction, I talk about the fact that Helena Maloney says that she can't understand why people can't accept that women have an ideology, develop their own politics and stick with it for their lifetimes.
Well, that's a perfect note on which to end our discussion tonight. Always brilliant talking to Mary McAuliffe, an absolutely brilliant historian. And her new book is a biography of Margaret Skinner, part of the Life and Times series, published in paperback by UCD Press. It costs €17. The book called Margaret Skinner, the author Mary McAuliffe. And Mary, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History, on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new novel set in 13th century Europe is a book about authority and corruption, the power battle between church and state, and the importance of translations. It's called A Matter of Interpretation. It's published in hardback by Fairlight Books and costs €15. The author is Elizabeth MacDonald. And Elizabeth, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you.
It's fascinating the way you are able to give us this new look at the 13th century, and you tease out some very interesting historical questions and some big historical questions, and it's all centred around this idea of translation. And of course, you have an expertise as well when it comes to translation. I think you've translated the stories of Liam O'Flaherty into Italian. You're a very distinguished academic and translator. Do you think that gave you a special insight when it came to writing about a different century?
It may well have, and I suppose even starting with the title of the novel, A Matter of Interpretation, translation is a key aspect here. And while my own area of translation is mostly poetry and prose, it was very interesting to see how the transmission of knowledge, translation played a crucial role in this. Above all, this figure of Michael Scott, who did actually exist and moved to Sicily, where he was given a commission by the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II to seek after this novo sapere, this new knowledge, as it was called, basically the rediscovery of Aristotle's lost writings, I think might be accurate to call them. They had been translated directly from the Greek, but Michael Scott rediscovered them in their Arabic translations. So translation, again, it played a very important role here because we're basically looking at Aristotle through the filter of four languages, Greek, Syriac, Arabic, and then finally Latin. I found that very interesting as a translator, yeah.
And this brings Michael Scott into all kinds of controversy and all kinds of trouble. Why was this lost knowledge so controversial at the time? And why did people in the church feel threatened by it?
Right. Well, I guess it's true to say that the church was or did feel threatened by it, probably because Aristotle was, as I understand it, not a big fan of religion. Philosophy was his main preoccupation. The same thing could be said for Averroes, the Muslim philosopher who translated these works on natural philosophy by Aristotle. The church, I think, would have felt threatened by this, the unmoved mover, as it were, this impersonal approach to God. The church would have had a vested interest in a personal God. And I think the church was worried at the centrifugal effect that individual interpretations of this approach to religion, as it were, Aristotle and the Muslim philosopher. And they may have decided that it was necessary to put a lid on this, block it, in case it gave rise to, dissension and then schism. And to a certain extent, they were probably right. The mills of God move very, very slowly. And for an individual life, such as Michael Scott, and he was translating this work, 20 years was nothing to the church, nothing. But 20 years to Michael Scott was a long time, and it put his career on hold, as it were. So they blocked the translations, they censored them, but ultimately it has to be said, after 20 years, they unblocked them and the knowledge was disseminated once a way was found to integrate this new knowledge.
Did you feel bound by the historical record of what you knew actually happened? Or did you feel that as a novelist, you could take some liberties and maybe make some changes for the sake of the story?
To be quite honest, no, I would have felt bound by the historical facts. I mean, facts are facts, and I don't feel that I can play around with them. However, certain areas of Michael Scott's life are not actually clear. So where there was a doubt, I felt I could interpret. What I did feel I could do was flesh out the feelings, the psychological conflict that may have underpinned certain courses of action that the man or Frederick or other characters in the novel, why they would have made choices that they did. That, I feel, is the work of the novel. The factual part, the history, is not open to interpretation. The facts are what they are. So I think actually that the novel can make history personal. It's a little bit like what Aquinas did for Aristotle's Unmoved Mover. The novel can make real the people behind the ideas and facts that amount to history. And in this way, the psychological mindset that may have given rise to courses of action, both questionable and otherwise, becomes manifest. Readers can open up to the motivating forces behind the choices, which are often hidden and unacknowledged, that underpin historical events. Novels are most interesting in this sense, that is, when they shine a light on the psychological conflict at the root of bad choices and negative courses of action. So at its best, a novel can arouse empathy, and this empathy with the stuff of the human heart at work might help to prevent similar negative choices and courses of action being repeated now. It's almost as if the historical novel can be a remedy to fake news.
Well, I think that's a brilliant reason for why historical fiction matters. Elizabeth, it's a novel I enjoyed. Are you tempted to write another one set in the 13th century or another one set in a different one? Will you jump around your time periods?
That's a very good question. I think actually I would prefer to, my next novel, as it were, is going to be contemporary. But I think I've already come up with the novel after that. It will be historical again, but it's going to the 16th century. I think I'd like to engage with something contemporary before I do that, however. The 13th century, I think what I found most interesting in the 13th century was that for me it was a tipping point, at least in Christendom, because it changed the way that knowledge is power, and the administrators of power up to that point had been basically emperor and pope. The 13th century, the very beginning of the 13th century, what entered the equation was learning and study. The universities became freer. At least that was the case in Christendom. It wasn't the case, however, in the Muslim world, where the same struggle had been taking place between theology and philosophy, reason and faith. In the Muslim world, I think I can say that theology won out. In the Christian world, in Christendom, however, the university became a force to be reckoned with. It was almost like a mediation between emperor and pope. Knowledge had its first impetus towards being free, and I think the 13th century is remarkable for that. I've tried to draw on that fact in A Matter of Interpretation.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me tonight to talk about the novel. It's called, as you say, A Matter of Interpretation, published in hardback by Fairlight Books. It costs €15. The author, Elizabeth MacDonald. And Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, it was a pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History, on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. From the prize-winning author of Ring of Steel comes a gripping history of the First World War's longest and most terrible siege. Almost unknown in the West, this was one of the great turning points of the conflict. If the Russians had broken through, they could have invaded Central Europe. But by the time the fortress fell, their strength was so sapped they could go no further. The book is called The Fortress, The Great Siege of Przemyśle. It's published in hardback by Allen Lane and costs £25 sterling, so about €30. The author is Alexander Watson. And Alexander, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me on.
This is, first of all, a siege I'd never heard of, and secondly, wasn't entirely sure how to pronounce until I was talking to you. Talk to me about this fortress. Why was it so significant?
So the fortress is the main Habsburg defence in the east of the empire. It lies in a region which today is covered by Poland and Ukraine. And at the start of the First World War, there was huge, huge fighting in that region. We tend to remember what went on in France and Belgium and our part of the world. But the fighting in what today is Poland, Ukraine, was even worse, or certainly at least as bad. Huge clashes between the Russian armies and the Habsburg army. Within the first month of fighting, the Habsburgs are routed. And this fortress, which is today just inside Poland, that time had a population around 50,000 Poles, Ukrainians, Jews. It was very, very diverse, as most cities in that region were at the time. And is defended by this remarkable garrison drawn from right across the continent. Suddenly and unexpectedly finds itself the Habsburg Empire's last defense against this mighty, mighty Russian invading force. And the book tells the story of what happened over the following 7 months, the longest siege of the First World War.
Yeah, 181 days in total. And what's remarkable is that many of the things that we see in terms of aerial bombing and so on are things we really associate with the Second World War and not with the First World War.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, there's vicious fighting, there's aerial bombing, there's also strategies of starvation, and as well, maybe in some ways most importantly, there's ethnic cleansing. Both sides execute and kill and deport people on the basis of their ethnicity, on the basis of their race. And the Russian army, in fact, is particularly menacing. It's carrying out East Central Europe's first planned program of ethnic cleansing. It intends not just to conquer the region, but actually change its population. It wants to turn Ukrainians into Russians by converting them to Russian Orthodoxy, by changing the language that they speak. And most importantly as well, it persecutes Jews. It deports more than 100,000 Jews. And when it captures Przemyśle in March 1915, a few months after, it forcibly removes 17,000 from the city. And of course, this is exactly the region, which is the epicenter of the Holocaust 20 years later. So one of the points I wanted to make in the book is that Europe's catastrophe really, really begins not in 1939 with the start of the Second World War, or even 1928-33 with the rise of Hitler and so on, but it begins in 1914. These imperialist ideas, racist ideas, you already see them with what the Russians are doing in 1914 in East Central Europe.
There's a remarkable multinational composition in the fortress, and what you also see is an extraordinary range of human experiences, and that human dimension to the siege is something you bring out very well in the book.
Well, thanks. Well, that's good to know, because that was really, really important to me. The garrison is drawn from this huge ancient, or fairly old empire, which covered Central Europe. So there are Czechs, Austrian Germans, Hungarians, Slovaks, Romanians, Serbs, some Italians, all sorts of people in this fortress garrison. And yeah, it was really interesting to see how they interact, how this incredibly multi-ethnic army, a bit like a European Union army, would potentially fight. It doesn't always go terribly well. There's all sorts of internecine hatreds within the fortress. The Germans don't like the Czechs. The Hungarians aren't keen on the Romanians. No one likes the Hungarians. But it was really, really interesting to pick out all of these different ethnicities, different points of view, and also tell a story that isn't a national story. Tell a story that's genuinely multi-international.
Very good. And finally then, in terms of what might have happened, if the fortress had fallen, how could that have changed the outcome of the war?
Well, the fortress does, of course, fall in March 1915. And that ultimately has a big impact in damaging the Habsburg army and damaging the Habsburg Empire and preparing the way for its collapse just a few years later. It's a huge loss of prestige. But the key point at which the Habsburg Empire is most vulnerable in 1914 is that first month after the war when its army has been routed. And it does look like the Russians are going to either break into Hungary or into Germany, or through as well further west, pass into what today is Western Poland. And the fortress just manages long enough to pin enough forces down to allow the Habsburg army to regenerate, to restore its order, to bring up new troops, and to go back into the battle. So it's touch and go above all in September 1914, but it's entirely plausible that if the fortress had fallen, then the Habsburg Empire would have been invaded. The Germans were already having huge problems in the west, didn't have troops to come over to the east. And yeah, I think we would have seen a much quicker war. So the war would likely have ended already in 1915 with a Central Powers defeat. We wouldn't, of course, have seen Irish independence in that context, not at that time anyway. And we would have seen a Russian-dominated Europe 30 years before that actually happened.
Very good. Well, it's an extraordinary story. The Fortress, the Great Siege of Przemyśla. It's published in hardback by Alan Lane and costs £25 sterling, so about €30. The author, Alexander Watson. And Alexander, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Talking History on News Talk. Well, welcome back to Talking History. Mary Ann McCracken was an abolitionist, a social reformer, and an activist who fought for the rights of women and championed Belfast poor throughout a long life that encompassed the most turbulent years of Irish history. And a new edition of The Life and Times of Mary Ann McCracken has been published in hardback by Irish Academic Press. It costs €22.95. The author is the late Mary McNeil, and it has a brilliant new foreword by Marianne Elliott. And I'm delighted to welcome Marianne to the show tonight. Marianne, you're so welcome back to the show.
Great. Yeah, glad to be back, Patrick.
Can we talk about Mary Ann McCracken? Who was she? She had this remarkable career, but she's probably overshadowed by her brother, Henry Joy McCracken.
Yeah, she is indeed. I mean, she's coming back, with all the interest in women's history now, there is a lot more interest in her. But we wouldn't actually know so much about the United Irishmen in the North in particular, were it not for her extraordinary correspondence with her brothers. She was quite a remarkable woman, and of course, although she was very young, she was just in her early 20s, you know, in the 1790s, but she lived till 1869. And she carried on campaigning for the causes that she and the United Irishmen had campaigned for way back in the 1790s, right till the end.
And there are so many different dimensions to her career. She was a lifelong abolitionist. She believed in the education of children, the rights of women, that she had so many of these advanced progressive views.
Indeed. It would be difficult to over praise her, even when she was young. I think she was only 22. She and her sister established their own muslin business and ran that while she was, writing about all the causes of the time. And she was a very notable philanthropic employer. Way back then, even in the 1790s, she believed that it was an employer's duty to give time to the employees for leisure and to educate themselves, which, we're still talking about those things today.
And even in her 80s, she was there handing out anti-slavery leaflets.
She was indeed. And the reason that this lovely book has been brought out again, and I was absolutely delighted. I remember purchasing it when I was a student And even by that stage, you know, in the 1970s, it had acquired legendary status. It was first published in 1960, and it was launched back then in Clifton House, where it was relaunched, the new edition, in this September. So the Clifton House Poor House, it was set up, of course, by the members of the Joy family and others who were volunteers and then United Irishmen. So they were there at the beginning, and Mary was very heavily involved in the 1790s and continued involvement until her death. She ran what was known as the Ladies Committee, that took a particular interest in the education of poor girls, working class girls, and so, very long career.
And the author, Mary McNeill, she had a remarkable career as well. And
she did.
And similarly was active in support of children and disadvantaged throughout her life.
She was, in many ways. You know, it makes sense that she was so interested in Mary Ann McCracken, because in many ways her own life reflected all the same interests, the interests with the poor and with children, with education. And because she came from quite a well-off middle-class family, much like Mary Ann McCracken did, very highly educated, and so she could afford to devote her own entire life to all of this. But it is actually very exciting that this book, and when they asked me to do a new foreword, I read it again. I hadn't read it, you know, for many decades, and it still is fresh. It was just remarkable for the time, that kind of book. And of course, as you will know yourself, Patrick, Mary Ann McCracken's letters were donated to via Dr. Madden, the historian, the 19th century historian of the United Irishmen, and ended up in Trinity College Dublin. And us historians, you know, including yourself, working on the United Irishmen, would not have known as much had she not been such a prolific letter writer.
And a final question. It has the subtitle A Belfast Panorama, and you do get this panoramic view of Belfast in the late 18th and 19th century through her work.
Yes, you do, because I mean, her family, you know, were enlightened entrepreneurs. You know, they lived at Belfast was very small in those days. But that, you know, they were involved in the newspapers. You know, her mother's family had set up the Belfast Newsletter, the oldest English language print newspaper still in print. But were also involved in, and became very, very heavily involved with radical Belfast at the end of the 18th century. So yes, through her. So her correspondence, and particularly with her brother Henry Joy McCracken, they were so close. And when he was in prison for a long time, that generated a huge volume of letters, and that's where we get so much information. Just, they're absolutely magical to read.
Okay, well, Mary Ann Elliott, thank you so much for joining me tonight to talk about The Life and Times of Mary Ann McCracken, A Belfast Panorama, published in hardback by Irish Academic Press. It costs €22.95, by Mary McNeill, the late Mary McNeill, with a wonderful new foreword by the brilliant Mary Ann Elliott. And Mary Ann, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, take care. Thank you, Patrick.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll be looking at a century of Irish foreign policy, and we'll be finding out how Ireland took her place among the nations of the world. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.